Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Exactly 200 years ago, Vermonters suffered through what many people believe is the harshest summer in the history of the state. There were hard frosts during every summer month. Cabot got 20 inches of snow on June 8th, and thousands of Vermonters fled the state thinking weather patterns had changed forever. What impact did this drastic weather have on the state? Today in the program, our guest is historian Howard Coffin. Howard, great to have you back on the program.
Always a pleasure to be here, Bob.
And you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. Do you have some questions about this very unusual summer in 1816? How do you think folks would react today to these kinds of weather conditions? A hard frost during every summer month, killing off vegetables and most sources of food. And perhaps you're aware of some references to the summer of 1816 in your own community. Please share those with us. 1-800-639-2211. So, Howard, take us back to the summer of 1816. You know, what I find kind of remarkable about reading about that particular summer is that it wasn't warm sometimes. It was that there were cold snaps in every month. So, for instance, on June 22nd, it was 101 degrees. On July 6th, it's 30. And you see this pattern repeating itself, and that's why vegetables start growing and freeze on the vine. So take us back to that night, that summer.
Well, it wasn't only cold and there were crops dying and so forth, but something close to terror settled in on Vermont. The skies went dark. The sun dimmed. You could look directly at the sun and see a halo around the sun in spots. There were no weather forecasters or news organizations to tell what was happening. It had to be an act of God. Listen to Walter Hill Crockett, the Vermont historian. The leaves of the trees were killed. Even the beeches did not put out leaves. Sheep had just been sheared, and where it was possible, the fleeces were bound around their bodies to keep them from freezing. There was great suffering, but little actual starvation. Days of fasting and prayer were observed in the churches. As a rule, people helped each other. It was tough times, but why? People didn't know, but of course we now know that the previous year, in September, a tremendous volcanic explosion had occurred in the Pacific. Mount Tambora had blown up, 100 times more powerful than Mount St. Helens, and spread an ash cloud around the world that really did not reach Vermont until 200 years ago, really next Monday. It was on June 5th that a mild spring began to turn very chilly.
Howard, we got this from Cynthia in Arlington. I've seen references to this particular year as 1816 and 18 and froze to death, maybe starved to death given the crop failures. And as you were saying, people really didn't know what was happening. And Cynthia wonders whether people had any understanding of what was happening and why at the time. So was the prevalent thought that this was the wrath of God?
Oh, I think that was a prevalent thought. Now, a religious revival had already begun some years earlier in Vermont. These were tough times for Vermont. The War of 1812, and then it ends in 1814. The British flood Vermont markets with goods in revenge. Vermont's economy plunges. Troubled times, and the churches begin to fill up. But then when the skies go dark, my goodness, you know, Bob, I'm a member of the United Church of Bethel, and they built that wonderful brick church in 1816, and Janet Burnham, the church historian, is convinced that it came about in fear and of God and in honor of God. Help us out of this. Actually, our birthday will be Christmas. Christmas Eve, we'll have a great celebration at that church. But yes, it brought people to the churches, but it also caused a lot of Vermonters to pack up and leave the state.
You know, on the same lines, we got this email from Woody up in Burlington that the Unitarian Church at the top of Church Street in Burlington was constructed during the year 1816, completed just before Christmas of that year. Interesting to contemplate that the entire building was completed between April 1816 and January of 1817. It's said that due to the year without a summer, many workers who would have been engaged in farming instead worked on building the church.
Well, I think, of course, in many ways, there wasn't much farming to do because the crops were dying. I would say that the odds are that that's no coincidence that that church went up in 1816. I said that Bethel did. There was a church that really had its beginnings up in Canaan in 1816. I'd be interested to know if there are people in Vermont who know more about them. I'm still researching this subject.
You know, what's amazing to think about, too, is these cold snaps that happen every single month during the summer. And this is a time when folks pretty much grow their own food for themselves and for their farm animals. And all of a sudden, this is having a huge impact on their daily lives.
Yes, they are. It's subsistence living. A lot of wild turnips are dug out of the ground and the wheat. Wheat is boiled to make some kind of horrible puddings mixed with vinegar. There are not a lot of cases that I can see of starvation. I've seen one instance at least of a farmer who can't keep his crops, his cattle alive, and commits suicide. That apparently happened up around Craftsbury. But this phenomenon was worldwide. It wasn't just Vermont. And it was known in other places as the year without sun, the cold year, the poverty year. But as my grandmother used to tell me when I was a child, in Vermont it was 1800 and froze to death. And I think that was mainly a Vermont phrase.
Let's go to our callers and start with Chris in Randolph. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the program.
Hey. Hi, Bob. Chris Reckia from Randolph. How you doing? So I'm calling because we're celebrating our 200th anniversary of our house this year, too. It was built in 1816. It's a brick cape. And I have always just been amazed because I've heard that that was, you know, a year with no summer, basically, that they were able to do that. You know, I look at the hand-hewn beams and the foundation stones that are 10 or 12 feet long quarried, and I just cannot imagine how they did that and still, you know, what did they eat? How did they survive that summer and do that type of work? So I just wanted to share that. And it sounds like there were a lot of other buildings around the state that were built then too. But that's my comment.
Well, I would respond with that. One of my favorite sayings, desperate times require desperate measures. You know, Bob, I think as you know, another aspect of this dark year was that a drought hit the state, and it was a severe drought. And as autumn came on, forest fires ignited on the western side of Lake Champlain, from Plattsburgh down to, say, around Ticonderoga. And the smoke came across the lake, and at times, apparently, people in Burlington and Middlebury could only see about 20 feet ahead of themselves. Lake navigation was interrupted. And you talk about terror. I mean, they couldn't see, and probably breathing became very difficult.
Today on the program, our guest is historian Howard Coffin, and we're talking about the summer of 1816, the year there was no summer. Your thoughts, you can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Michael, who's calling from West Thompson.
West,
hey, Michael.
Topsom.
Topsom, okay, thank you.
It's on Route 25, southeast of Montpelier.
Yeah, we had a small typo on our screen. I apologize for that. Michael, what's on your mind today?
Well, I have my fourth great grandmother, Mary Hubbard Nye's diary from 1812 to 1838, and she writes daily in 1816 about the weather. For example, fourth day, Tuesday, some cloudy and cold rains night. Wednesday, some clear and warm in the afternoon till just night, a shower, some thunder. Thursday, very cold, a little snow, some rain in the forenoon. Snow squalls afterward on the ground. Was white with snow at night and freezing cold. Seventh day, Friday, very cold and windy. Vegetables froze, snow squalls towards night, ground covered with snow. And she continues, and she says, the ground covered with snow, all things look as if in mourning, and will not mankind mourn for sin, which is the cause of the Lord's bringing such judgments upon us. So there's a religious element that she expresses in the diary. And that the 10th day froze five nights. It seemed cold like winter. So she talks that, very explicitly about
that. Is wonderful. That's just the kind of thing I'm looking for. Michael, would you give me a call in Montpelier? I'm in the phone book. I want to talk to you more about that diary. Wonderful. Thank you. Of course, Bob, this was, as I said, a worldwide event, and it hit Europe hard. A famine was worsened in Ireland, thousands of deaths. But you know, in Switzerland, Lord Byron and Mary Shelley had gone to Switzerland for the summer to do some hiking and some writing, but they couldn't, they had to stay indoors. It was so cold and dark. And so they and a group of writers made up a little game, a contest to see who could write the best dark, somber story. And Mary Shelley produced the book Frankenstein. So that came out of this. And Lord Byron writes a poem about this. And just hear the first few lines. I had a dream, which was not a dream at all. The bright sun was extinguished, and the stars did wander, darkling in the eternal space, rayless and pathless, and the icy earth swung blind and blackening in the moonless air. Morn came and went and came and brought no day, and men forgot their passions in the dread of this desolation, and all hearts were chilled into a selfish prayer for light. Lord Byron writing on this.
You know, talking about the impact on the Vermont economy, previously you were talking about the War of 1812 and the British dumping a lot of products into Vermont in 1814. And then this hits, and food prices have got to just go through the roof for those people who can even afford them. So the Vermont economy has to be really on edge at that point.
Yes, some businesses were failing, and some Vermonters went back to charcoal kills to make potash, anything that they could find for an income. One strange phenomenon occurs up on the Missisquoi this summer. All of a sudden, the Missisquoi was filled with fish, and people set up nets all from Swanton to the mouth of the Missisquoi, and they were just bringing fish out of the lake by the bushel basket, and they were selling them statewide, and people found out about this and went up to Swanton to buy fish. It was a salvation for many people. Don't know why it happened.
And, of course, the farm animals, they had to either be slaughtered or they starved to death.
They did. And one point I want to make is that the storms that came in June, just 200 years ago, beginning next Sunday and Monday, these were major storms, drifts of snow 2 and 3 feet deep, people getting lost going out to look for their cattle. They dug one man up in Craftsbury out of a snowbank after he'd been gone for 3 days, but they apparently revived him. Children getting lost but being found. It was a winter of a summer, and then the heat shoots up. It keeps going on like this. It's crazy.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Jan in North Middlebury. Hi, Jan. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Hi, how are you? I actually live in North Middlesex and right at the base of Mount Hunger. And I've always been told, I've lived here for 38 years, and I've always been told that it got its name because of the summer of 1816 and how all the old-time homesteaders had to leave the mountain because they couldn't survive. And they turned and looked at it and said, that's Mount Hunger. And I wonder if this is true.
That's a story that I have never heard. I'm making note of it. There's also a Mount Hunger down in Barnard, but that supposedly was named when two early explorers of that Chattahoochee countryside starved to death on top of that hill. But this Mount Hunger story, I want to learn more about. Wonderful.
Jan, thanks very much for your phone call. Today in the program, our guest is historian Howard Coffin. We're talking about the summer of 1816. That's the year there was no summer. Your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today is historian Howard Coffin. We're going back exactly 200 years ago to the summer of 1816. That's the year there was no summer. Your thoughts or questions, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Howard, one thing we haven't talked about, we talked about the drought and certainly the impact that the lack of food had both on people and on animals. What about disease at the time? Well, that was also a problem, wasn't it?
I only seen a few references to disease, and the connection being that people were weakened by lack of adequate food supply and were subject to sickness. I have seen one account of the darkness, the cold, setting off an epidemic in Ireland that led to 100,000 deaths. But certainly, thank God, nothing like that in Vermont. Certainly there was an exodus.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Alan, who's calling from Burlington. Hi, Alan. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you. My wife has a real fascination with the history of the Mormon Church as a non-Mormon. And one of the things that she's pointed out is that Joseph Smith was born here, but as a little boy, his family moved away, I think, in the year after the year without a summer. And I think it's also interesting that one of the tenets of the church that he went on to found was that you keep a year's worth of food stashed in your house at all times. I just wondered if Jim could comment on that.
Alan, that's a great comment. That shows up in some of the historical records as well. Howard, what about that?
Yeah, the Smith family had moved from Sharon down to Norwich, and they, living in a small home down there, they had had a close call when their young boy was very young, getting very sick and being saved by Nathan Smith, who founded the Dartmouth Medical School, came up from Hanover to save him. But yes, they went to Western New York State, and 15,000 Vermonters left the state because to them it seemed like Vermont was changing permanently. In Hardwick, Abby Maria Hemingway's History of Hardwick notes that there were especially large numbers of people that left that town, and the ones who stayed said they had Genesee fever. Genesee fever, well, that's talking about Western New York State, the valley of the Genesee River. That's apparently where they were headed. But apparently other Vermonters went further west, maybe to Ohio and perhaps even further. And this catastrophe can be traced as a cause of speeding the great westward migration in America.
I mean, you mentioned 15,000 Vermonters get up and leave and go to the Midwest. So let's put that in perspective. Is that like 10% of the state at the time or something like that?
Yeah, I would say it's about that. And of course, today I think if you had an exodus like that, you'd be looking at probably 50,000 people going half of Greater Burlington, perhaps. It would be a tremendous impact.
And certainly, you had people who probably wanted to leave, but they couldn't. I mean, were they sort of tied here financially, or did people just say, "I don't care, I'm out of here"?
Well, my suspicion is that probably a lot of them who left were younger people. The same thing, of course, happened after the Civil War. The soldiers had come home, and they'd had a great adventure, and they'd seen flatter farmlands, and they come back, and all of a sudden these guys who had won a great war were having to take orders from the old man again. And many of these young soldiers, probably 15,000, head off to the west, head off a little to the south, start a life of their own. So, it was also, of course, a good excuse for a young person who wants to try something new. This is a great chance to slip away, a good reason, you see.
And this happens when Vermont, prior to 1816, there's a big population surge in the decade or two before that. And so this is a real reversal of what Vermont had been experiencing.
Oh, yes. You know, I wonder, so much of Vermont's difficulties at this time are tied to the War of 1812. And, of course, the decisive battle of that war is fought at Plattsburgh on the land and on the lake. A tremendous battle over there. And the land battle, there were more Vermonters involved than New Yorkers. And I wonder if some of the British anger and the economic chaos they wreaked on Vermont right after the war might have had something to do with our intervention over there on the western shore of Lake Champlain.
And some communities in Vermont are really hard hit to the point where there are very few people left in these towns.
I think perhaps the hardest hit may have been Richford. Apparently, Richford was devastated, and a lot of the town's people just got up and went off. So I suspect that the weather was extremely harsh there. And generally speaking, the weather in 1816 seems to have been worse the further north that you went. And, of course, as it seems always true, the kingdom gets it worse.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Susan, who is calling from West Rupert. Hi, Susan.
Yes.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I wondered if Helen Collin had heard. I have been told that from an elderly lady that grew up in Fairfield, born and everything in Fairfield, and somewhere in Bakersfield, there is a place called Egypt. And she said people were up there were able to grow their crops and not be affected as much as other people. And I wondered if Howard had heard of that story.
I have not. That's a brand new one to me. I do know of Egypt. I ran on to Egypt doing some Civil War research a few years ago. But thank you. I'm certainly going to track that one.
Susan, thanks for your phone call. Let's turn to Matt, who's calling from Barry. Hey, Matt, what's on your mind today?
So I was listening to a podcast the other day about the, I forget the name of the volcano that caused all this.
Tambora.
They were trying to weave a story about how Mary Shelley, you know, who wrote Frankenstein, that it was because of that lack of summer that they were stuck indoors more. And they were saying that that was how Frankenstein developed, because when they'd normally be hanging out in the Mediterranean or whatever they were doing, they were stuck indoors. I'm wondering if there's any similar things that happen with Vermont artisans, whether it be writers or artists or anything. Is there any recorded output from that summer? Yeah.
There, not that really that I know of, except a poem emerged, an anonymous poem emerged in 1816 that has sort of been the poem for that time that you still see in a lot of books today. It's very brief. I'll read it. If God withholds those milder rays and sends us frosts and chilling days, Eames snow as late as 8th of June that nips the fruit in early blooms. Shall we be frightened by such things? No, rather frightened at our sins. So he's getting, or she's getting, to the religious aspect of all this.
Today in the program, our guest is historian Howard Coffin. We're looking at the summer of 1816, the year there was no summer. Your thoughts, give us a call. If you've got some questions, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Let's turn to Roger in Burlington. Hey, Roger, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me on. I don't have a question, a comment. I think my information is correct here. In the early years, like 1812, 1813, Middlebury College collected a lot of pledges in order to go tuition-free. And, you know, those pledges were just never met after that year. I don't think it ever happened. I don't think Middlebury was ever tuition-free.
That is new to me. And, again, Middlebury is one of those towns that's very hard hit. There was a professor over there who was recording data on the weather, and they not only got the cold, but they got that smoke coming in from the Adirondacks that made it all far worse. And as you know, looking up at that sun with those sunspots and that weird ring, chilling. By the way, Bob, as Thanksgiving approached in 1816, now the governor is Jonas Galusha, and he issues a proclamation, as Vermont governors are wont to do, particularly in election months. The disposer of events has seen fit in his holy providence to blast our expectations in the latter harvest. We ought enter the courts of the Lord with penitence for sin, prayer for pardon, and descriptions of praise. There again, you see, touching on that element of fear.
They had to be fearful. I mean, you know, the sky was dark. It was snowing in June and July. They had to have been wondering, what the heck is going on? Their world is being turned upside down.
Well, I find it interesting that the great church on Church Street in Burlington and our church in Bethel are both built of brick. Our Bethel church from a brick made just down the street. In the 1890s, Reverend Parker, who was pastor of the church in Bethel, said that he thought that that church, if fairly well taken care of, would last hundreds of years. And, of course, it's 200 years old this year. But they were building these solid edifices to hopefully stand against only God knew what might be coming next year. And even the next year proved to be strange.
Did it? 1817, was that a tough year as well?
Well, it started out tough because in January, something called St. Elmo's Fire appeared in Vermont. And it's something like lightning, and it's something to do with electricity in the atmosphere. And by the way, there was a lot of thunder during 1816, and that came back in January of 1817, and strange lights danced along the wooden fences and the fence posts. This light and fire came down on rooftops and church steeples. Some people's hair looked as if it was on fire, and their hats lighted up with a great glow. Now, I mean, after what they'd been through, this was really scary.
Let's talk to Greg in Burlington. Hey, Greg, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. Hearing your guest's name, Mr. Coffin, I thought, were burials a problem in this the hard ground too hard in this period of time?
I haven't run across that, but one would suspect that perhaps they were, because certainly in late August and early September, there are references to the ground being frozen solid. So I would think that the tombs probably filled up.
Greg, thanks for your phone call. Let's turn to John in Essex Junction. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I was born in Chittenden, Vermont, and my grandfather was born there in 1875, and he died in 1961. And he told me that in behind Chittenden Reservoir, there used to be a community that no longer exists. It was called New Boston. And that it, he told me that it had 1,000 families and everybody moved out when in the Great Exodus.
I have I stumbled on New Boston once hiking on my way to climb Mount Carmel down there. I used to hike without going on a trail, and suddenly there was some marker on a tree that said I was in a place called New Boston, and I found some cellar holes. But I really don't know much about its history, except clearly there was an exodus from New Boston for some reason. Maybe this is it.
And we were talking about the migration in 1816. Does that continue now for a couple of years? As you're saying, the next year, 1817, was kind of a weird year, too. Does this migration take place for a couple of years?
Apparently it does, in maybe two or three years. You know, Bob, as I've been studying this, there comes to mind an incident that happened to me when I was about 9 years old in Woodstock, walking home one night from the Community Recreation Center after dark. I should have been studying, I'm sure, but not much of a student. And I was walking through across a bridge in the village. And as I say, it was dark and it was a cloudy night. And all of a sudden, the world went dark. All the lights in Woodstock failed at once. And I was in pitch black darkness. I'd been walking in the road. I couldn't get my hands on the rail of the bridge. And I was terrified. Had I died? Had I gone blind? And it was about 15 minutes before the lights came back on. But I discovered that, you know, that night there's nothing more terrifying than the loss of light. And this, as the light was fading from June on through the summer, the people didn't know but what it might be the final fading of the light, the end of it all. It must have been so scary.
Historian Howard Coffin, many, many thanks for sharing your information about this amazing time in Vermont history. And when weather conditions this summer are not absolutely perfect, let's all reflect on the summer of 1816, the summer of 18 and froze to death, to put our summer in 2016 in perspective. Howard, many thanks as always.
Yes, that was real climate change. I mean, we're getting it now, but my goodness, so sudden. Thank you.
Coming up next, I'll talk with 7 Days reporter Paul Heintz about next week's Democratic presidential primary in California and what it means to the campaign of Bernie Sanders. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. The race for the Democratic presidential nomination runs through California next Tuesday, and the campaign of Senator Bernie Sanders is waging an all-out effort to win this primary. How would a Sanders victory in California change the dynamics of the Democratic race? 7 Days political reporter Paul Heintz has been following the Sanders campaign since day one, and he joins us now to talk about the future of the campaign. Hey, Paul, thanks for being here.
Happy to be here, Bob. What is this, day 370-something?
It's really amazing that it's been going on for more than a year when you think about that.
It really has.
So, Paul, Bernie Sanders is campaigning day and night in California. He's drawing big crowds throughout the state. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is now back in California because there's a sense that Sanders is surging and making up ground in these final days before Tuesday's primary. In fact, the latest poll shows Sanders down by just 2 points, well within the margin of error. So what's at stake for the Sanders campaign in California?
Well, at a practical level, 546 delegates are at stake there. It is a massive state, of course, and this is also the last real day of voting. There will be one more primary after next Tuesday in the District of Columbia, but this is really the last gasp. And not only is California voting, but a couple other smaller states, New Jersey, New Mexico, North Dakota, South Dakota. But California is the big kahuna. So I think the logic that the Sanders campaign sees is a win in California will show that Sanders remains viable and that Secretary Clinton has really not locked this thing up.
So, Paul, I wonder how having Donald Trump as the presumed Republican presidential nominee affects this Democratic race now. Because this week we saw California Governor Jerry Brown endorse Hillary Clinton. Now, Brown says he agrees with Sanders on many issues, but he's supporting Clinton because it's critical for the Democrats to defeat Trump. Is this the dilemma that Sanders faces in California?
Well, it is, but it's also an argument that he has seized on himself. So while Jerry Brown and Hillary Clinton's campaign have said she's the only one who can beat Donald Trump, Sanders and his campaign points to public opinion polling that shows that Sanders often actually does better in head-to-head polls against Trump. So Team Sanders says, hey, actually, we're the ones who can beat Trump. You know, there's quite a bit of dispute over that fact, but it's certainly sort of dominating the narrative at the moment.
And if Sanders does win California, is that an argument that Sanders will make to the superdelegates in the next 6 weeks?
That's certainly his goal, and that's really his only path forward, because if you look at the actual pledged delegates, how many have been awarded to either candidate, Secretary Clinton remains pretty far ahead. When you factor in these superdelegates, she is overwhelmingly ahead. In fact, she only needs to win 71 more delegates in order to lock this thing up, and a lot of people expect that will happen around 8 p.m. Next Tuesday when New Jersey starts reporting its final numbers. So, you know, even if Sanders wins in California, even if he wins in all of the states that vote on Tuesday, he needs to do more than that just to tie things up with pledged delegates. He needs to win about 67% of the vote, something that he has very rarely done. And so if he doesn't do that, then he's going to need to try to convince superdelegates to change their mind, something that they tend not to do. Once people lock in, they tend to stay where they are.
Now, Paul, if Sanders does win California and a couple of the other states that you mentioned, does it underscore some of Clinton's shortcomings as a candidate, including questions about her email server as Secretary of State and her very high unfavorable ratings?
Yeah, I think it does. And I think that's what you'll hear from the Sanders campaign. You know, they've said they've got enough money to stay in it through the convention, win or lose on Tuesday. I think the one big X factor out there is the result of this ongoing FBI investigation into Secretary Clinton's emails. We saw a report come out recently from the State Department's Inspector General. But we're still waiting on the FBI to conclude its investigation. So I think the Sanders campaign and certainly Sanders supporters are hoping that something big comes of that.
Paul, we're already seeing some Democratic leaders calling on Sanders to wrap things up. And we should mention that most of these people do support Hillary Clinton. And they claim that Sanders really has no chance of winning and that by staying in the race, he's forcing Clinton to spend a lot of money. Think of all the media money in California this week. And it takes her attention away from Donald Trump. So if Sanders loses California, can we expect that message to grow even louder?
Absolutely. I think you're seeing a lot of frustration from Clinton supporters and sort of mainstream Democrats that Hillary Clinton even has to go out to California this week and campaign. She wasn't really originally scheduled to do that. And her supporters say she shouldn't be going out to this true blue state. She should be focusing on Donald Trump at this point. It'll be interesting to see what happens after Tuesday. I would expect a lot of party leaders who've stayed on the sidelines to become more vocal. And I wonder if someone like President Obama himself might signal or Vice President Biden might signal that they believe this thing is over, you know, no matter what happens on Tuesday.
Paul, I can't tell you how many people in Vermont have asked me this question. If Clinton gets the Democratic nomination, is there any chance that she picks Bernie Sanders as her running mate?
You know, I really don't think there's much of a chance at all. And I think one of the reasons is they just don't have much chemistry. I don't think that Team Clinton really trusts Bernie Sanders, and I don't think they believe that he would be a true ally. It could cause a lot of drama for them down the road. I think they want someone who's going to be cooperative and be supportive of the ticket and not just challenging them at every move. I also wonder if Bernie Sanders would even want that role. You know, it would require him making some compromises and sacrifices that he might not want to. That said, I think that there will be a lot of pressure for Secretary Clinton to pick somebody who liberals, who progressives can really get behind. You know, so I think that a lot of people who have supported Bernie Sanders would love to see someone like Elizabeth Warren on the ticket, or perhaps someone like Sherrod Brown, people who are reliably progressive.
Paul, let's turn to some other political news. At the candidate filing deadline last Thursday, we learned that Scott Milne is seeking the GOP nomination for the U.S. Senate. Milne was the Republican candidate for governor in 2014. He almost defeated incumbent Democrat Peter Shumlin. Milne is challenging incumbent Senator Patrick Leahy, who has served in the Senate for seven terms or 42 years. Milne says, hey, it's time for a change. 42 years is long enough for anybody to serve in the U.S. Senate. How do you see this race shaping up?
I think it could be a very interesting race. It's been since 1992 that Senator Leahy had any kind of real opposition from Jim Douglas. And I think that Scott Milne certainly showed 2 years ago that he is able to convince people to vote for him. There are a couple of different dynamics at play. This is different than 2014 because it's a presidential year. So most analysts expect many more Democrats to turn out this year and for people like Senator Leahy to be in a better position. That said, I think that there is some fatigue with people who've been serving in Washington for some time. And you can tell from the way Scott Milne talks about this race that he's really going to push that line. He continues to call Senator Leahy a Washington insider, a career politician, that sort of thing. And he points to the tremendous amount of money that Senator Leahy has raised over the years, sometimes from special interest groups. So I think that will be a theme of his argument.
You know, Paul, a lot of people underestimated Scott Milne's candidacy in the 2014 gubernatorial race, yet he lost by only a couple of thousand votes. I mean, could the same thing happen this year?
Well, anything is possible. I do think that back then, the gubernatorial race was more of a referendum on Peter Shumlin. He was quite unpopular at the time. And I think that many people who voted for Scott Milne were really just voting against Peter Shumlin. Now, public opinion polling shows that Senator Leahy has higher favorability than Shumlin did at that time. And again, because this is a presidential election year, I think you'll have more Democrats in the mix. One X factor is whether supporters of Bernie Sanders hold it against Senator Leahy that he has been a supporter of Hillary Clinton. That's something that we won't know for some time.
Paul, Milne also wants to portray Leahy as the defender of the status quo. He's been in the Senate for 42 years. Milne sees himself as the challenger to the current political system. This is the year of the outsider. Could this be an effective message in Vermont this year?
It could be a very effective message. But, you know, there are a lot of sort of basic things that you need to do as a candidate to be competitive. I mean, you do need to raise a lot of money. You need to have a competent campaign staff. And you need to have an infrastructure, a party infrastructure that will support you. And it remains to be seen whether Milne will put that together, whether the Vermont Republican Party will put that together. Milne himself says he's not going to even start campaigning until after the 4th of July holiday. And, you know, if you're going to try to take down someone like Patrick Leahy, you need to have a plan by months ago, and you need to have all the pieces in place.
We'll be following this race closely in the weeks and months ahead. Paul Heintz follows politics for 7 days. Paul, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you for having me on, Bob.
That's our program for today. This year marks the centennial of America's National Park Service. On the next Vermont edition, we'll talk about Vermont's own Marsh Billings Rockefeller National Historic Park in Woodstock and some of the characters behind it, conservationists, authors, and millionaires. Send your questions or comments to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen Monday at noon. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.